understanding, not necessarily among governments, but certainly among societies, companies, and others, of what is and isn't off limits. And one of the White House aides says to you as you're heading in, talk about anything you want, Brad, but don't mention this digital Geneva Convention thing. Now, this won't shock anybody who has come up against the Trump administration's allergy to anything that sounds like a treaty or international agreement, but what was that all about?
A great question. And first of all, David, it's great to be here with you. David and I have had the chance to engage in conversations together almost literally around the world, and thanks to all of you for coming. It is an interesting entry fee into this. I think one way to think about it is to start with the real Geneva Convention, or what it really is the Fourth Geneva Convention. In 1949, 4 years obviously after World War II ended, the International Committee for the Red Cross was able to bring together literally all the governments of the world in Geneva, where they agreed to and signed the Geneva Convention. And the basic principle was very straightforward. Countries said that even in a time of war, they had not just a moral responsibility, but they assumed a legal duty to protect civilians. So war would be fought, but the military would seek to avoid causing civilian casualties. And the basic point that we've raised, that we describe in this book and in this one chapter, is here it is, you know, 2019, mostly in the world, it's a time of peace. And yet we see governments attacking civilians on the internet. In some cases, we've seen them attacking civilians on an unprecedented scale. The biggest attack was 2 years ago. It was called WannaCry. It was launched by the North Korean government, and it literally impacted more than 300,000 computers in more than 150 countries. No time before in human history had any government managed to attack 150 countries in one day. So we said, look, we need a digital Geneva Convention. We need to bring the world together to pledge that it will protect civilians on the internet in a time of peace, just as it will protect civilians on a battlefield in a time of war. And as we share in that story, there were some places in the city where the reaction was a little less than enthusiastic about where we were proposing. And so I readily agreed, you know, walking into this meeting at the White House, they wanted us to talk about other things, specifically cybersecurity recommendations for the executive branch, and they basically said, please don't derail it. So I'm like, oh, fine, I got your message. I will not raise this issue. And as I share in the Caroline and I together share the book, we sit down in this elaborate, ornate conference room, and about 20 minutes into the meeting, another business leader, a CEO, was sitting there, and he leaned across the table, and he said to the staff from the White House, look, what we really need is a digital Geneva Convention. And the person from the White House looked at me, and I'm like, look, I did not put him up to this, I promise, it wasn't me.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned WannaCry, which, of course, was an attack on the North Koreans, which took out a good part of the British healthcare system. And, of course, it was followed later on, just a few months later, by something called NotPetya, which may have been the most expensive cyber attack. WannaCry was based, at least in part, on a vulnerability now called Eternal Blue that came out of a Microsoft piece of Microsoft operating system. And as we dug into it, it turned out to have been stolen or leaked out of the National Security Agency. It was a vulnerability made in Fort Meade. And there's another great story in the book about a day that the NSA officials call you somewhat embarrassed to say, we've got a little problem. We think there was a vulnerability here, and you've got to get out and fix it. Now, they had had this vulnerability in their hands for months, years, but they only managed to mention it to you when it was stolen. What was that all about?
Well, it's a fascinating issue because I think it really matters, you know, to all of us. And, you know, I can't help about it without actually saying. And a lot of what we know about this was brought to our attention by David E. Sanger of the New York Times in his reporting, as well as by the Washington Post. And the basic story that, you know, David, you brought to light, that the Post has brought to light, is that the NSA had identified a vulnerability in a version of Windows. Actually, it was the Post that then, after you reported it, said later that there had been a vibrant debate within the NSA about whether to disclose it to us so we could fix it.
And this was years ago.
This was years ago. I mean, basically, the Post, this all unfolded with these attacks in 2017. The Post suggested that these debates within the NSA had happened 5 years earlier. And you probably won't be surprised to hear that the view of tech companies is basically, please, you know, tell us when you find these things so we can fix them and patch them. You can also understand that many governments might say, well, wait a second, you know, we could do that, or we could use this and exploit this ourselves. According to the reporting, this particular vulnerability was regarded as so dangerous that if it wasn't fixed, it would really pose a great risk. Yeah, but nonetheless,
it turns out to have been true.
Yeah, no, and supposedly, you know, the debate was, well, gee, you know, what if this falls into the wrong hands? And you know, it did fall into the wrong hands, we were given some time, as it turned out, to get a patch out into the marketplace before the first real exploit was launched by North Korea in May of 2017. But as with many things, you know, some people had applied the patch and some had not. And so, you know, any machine that wasn't patched was very vulnerable. We had also provided the patch free of charge for everybody who had Windows 7. Windows XP was, as you all may know, a much older operating system. We had a subscription service at that point where people could continue to get patches if they subscribed. But in this case, you know, we just scrambled and we shared the story about the debate inside Microsoft, and we just said, you know, we're going to make this available to everybody immediately free of charge just because this attack was spreading around the world and it was potentially so debilitating.
So what are we supposed to conclude about that? Because it fits right into your first point about the Digital Geneva Convention. So we're accustomed, Brad, to hearing, and you and I spend a lot of time talking about attacks launched from China or Russia, Iran, North Korea, as we've just discussed. But here was a case where the U.S. government had in its hands evidence of a flaw that I presume you didn't know about at Microsoft, but it was in your product. So you felt some responsibility to get out and fix it, right? The way an auto company would have a responsibility if they discovered they had a flaw in their airbags, right? Would it have made a difference if the U.S. government had come to you 5 years before and said, Brad, you got a problem in your software. You got to get out and fix this.
Oh, I have every reason to believe that if they had come to us 5 years before, two things would have happened. First, all of the versions of Windows at that time would have had the patch available, you know, within whether it was weeks or months, you know, depending on how difficult it was to create the patch. And then all future versions created after that would have not had that vulnerability because we would have known about it and known how to avoid it. So the world would have been safer.
Okay.
People's computers would have been safer.
So are we to conclude that the U.S. government learned a deep lesson from this and wouldn't harbor these kinds of vulnerabilities in the future?
This is like a reporter asking the wrong person the question. But I will say, I think that there have been some lessons learned, and one can always then debate whether all the lessons that need to be learned have in fact been applied. One lesson that we said needed to be learned was, look, first of all, if you are going to, in effect, create these weapons, you better guard them very carefully so you don't lose them. And as the WannaCry...
Seems like an uncontroversial position.
But it was, it was a fascinating thing because as this unfolded, you know, we felt obliged not only to do the first thing we needed to do, do is just sort of like, you know, help customers patch their machines and recover, because some customers were really facing debilitating losses, especially, as you say, a third of the hospitals in the United Kingdom stopped operating, you know, because they had old machines and they were just taken down by this. But so when we spoke about then the geopolitical issues, we said, look, this would be like, you know, the U.S. military losing control of its Tomahawk missiles. Because that, you know, is the thing we got to think about. You know, this may not like literally kill a person directly, but we open the chapter by telling the story of a man named Patrick Ward, who was literally awaiting heart surgery in London when his surgery was canceled that day. So people's lives were at risk. And it, interestingly, as you know, you know, we got a lot of pushback, you know, here in the United States and in the UK. You know, there were people who were very upset that we were comparing this to Tomahawk missiles. There were some employees in the intelligence community in the UK who we understood were writing a blog. They were so upset, saying, these aren't missiles, they're rifles. And I was a little bit like, well, first of all, has anybody ever fired a rifle and hit 150 countries? But second of all, like, that's sort of beside the point. It's like, this is a problem we need to solve. But there is this broader aspect, you know, as you know, it did lead the White House to refine to some degree what it calls its equities process. The equities process is where it says it balances the equities. On the one hand, they can tell a tech company about the vulnerability so it can be fixed. On the other hand, they can use this vulnerability to create their own weapon, if you will. How do they think about the equities? And at least from what they've, you know, said to us, this has led to more sharing of this kind of information with tech companies. And, you know, of course, we have no way of knowing ourselves. But if so, I think that's a good thing, and it is helping overall make the world safer.
I can tell you that when I used an analogy similar to the Tomahawk one, I got an hour and a half lecture from the NSA about how, no, they weren't responsible at all for this. The responsibility was entirely the North Koreans. So, which I thought was an interesting answer. Let me take you to a really fascinating part of your book that deals with privacy, a question we're all interested in. So, when I store my data on a Microsoft server, and I'm paying you to go keep that storage, I'm expecting that you're going to give it a fair bit of protection, the way if I rent a safe deposit box at a bank on Connecticut Avenue here, I'm expecting them not to leave the door open along the way. One day you got a subpoena from the U.S. government asking you to turn over some data that it turned out belonged not to a U.S. citizen, and that you weren't storing in the United States, you were storing it in Ireland. And this led to a fascinating, lengthy court battle in which you basically argued that it wasn't your responsibility to give this over to the U.S. government. If they wanted to get it, they should go to Ireland. Tell us a little bit about what happened and how you took on the U.S. government on this issue.
Yeah, I think it starts actually with an opportunity for everyone to sort of first get our minds around what it means to store data in the cloud. Because, you know, every day, you know, we send an email. We just think about all the photos we take. Think about text messages. You know, think about the documents we work on. And, you know, in the world today, the vast majority of those are all saved instantaneously, maybe both on our laptop or phone, but also, quote, in the cloud. Well, as we all know, you know, it's not really the cloud. You know, what it really means is a data center. And, you know, we open the introduction by taking people on a tour of something that almost no one gets to see, namely, what is it like to see a modern-day data center? And I think these are, in many respects, you know, some of the biggest, most complex parts of the infrastructure of our economy and our lives. Yeah, and if you make it to page 2, you'll see that. But data centers, of course, have a physical location. And yeah, of course, as you would imagine, if you're an American and you're in the United States and you're storing your data in the cloud, you know, it is in a data center in the United States. That does mean if that the U.S. government, with a proper search warrant or subpoena, can get access to it. But you would, I think, probably say, yeah, I get that. If I think about it, I know that. But I don't actually expect a foreign government to be able to come ask Microsoft for my data. And if it did, I would expect Microsoft to say no. Well, it turns out that everybody around the world basically thinks the same way. You know, so we have a huge data center campus, many buildings just south of Dublin. And as you would expect, you know, people in Europe, in some respects, in Northern and Western Africa, their data is stored in part in Dublin. And so we got this subpoena from the United States.
For a reason, Brad. I mean, for you want them to be able to retrieve it more quickly.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Basically, you know, it's really interesting because 10 years ago when tech companies started building these data centers, people thought, you know what, if we just build big enough data centers in the U.S., that'll take care of the world. But it doesn't really work that way because it does take time for data to move halfway around the world. It may be only half a second, but you know, it's really interesting how people just get annoyed if they have to wait a half a second, you know, for something to happen. So you know, we put data in data centers now, literally in many countries around the world. So a search warrant arrives. That's sort of a normal day, as we describe how it works. And then people look and they say, oh, wait a second, this is from the U.S. government. It's for data in Ireland. And we're not sure that a U.S. search warrant actually reaches Ireland. And so we had this conversation internally. And you know, we went back to the government, the Department of Justice, and said, yeah, we've read the law. We don't think a U.S. search warrant reaches Ireland. And by the way, you know, we have a great relationship with the Irish authorities. So do you. They're a close ally. They'll work with you. So instead of coming to us, you know, go to the Irish. And the U.S. government said, no, we don't want to go to the Irish. We don't want to tell the Irish that we're coming to get this. We just want you to give it to us. And, you know, at the same time this was happening, the shoe was on the other foot from the government of Brazil. We share this story. You know, we had data in the U.S. that belonged to a Brazilian individual, and the Brazilian police were saying, we want you to just turn this stuff over. And we're saying, actually, under U.S. law, if we turn it over to you, we will commit a felony under U.S. law, so no thank you. So they were prosecuting one of our executives in Brazil. And you know, eventually we just said, look, we're going to go to court, which we did, where we promptly lost. But we said, you know, we're going to fight this, and we're going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court if that's what it takes to establish a precedent, and then use this for what we think is needed, which is a new generation of laws and real agreements between countries, because you know, there are times when governments need data in other countries, but it's got to be pursuant to respect for borders, respect for human rights, and the like. And as we share the story, you know, it was quite a journey. It took us to the White House on multiple occasions, to Congress. Congress you know, started to move. It got to the Supreme Court, and then a new law was passed.
And so today?
Well, this is a fascinating one, you know, in its own right. We have a new law. The law sets certain restrictions on when, say, the U.S. government can go overseas to get data. Gives us the right to go to a court here and contest that in certain ways. But mostly what it does is it creates the foundation legally for these new international agreements. And part of what we're advocating for around the world is a new set of treaties between the U.S. and the U.K., the U.S. and Europe, the U.S. and New Zealand and the like. It's going to take a decade easily to put in place what the world really needs, which is the basis for data to move around, but people's fundamental rights to be protected, I think, the way they deserve.
So on our way into a discussion of China, which is particularly complex here, let's just ask where this intersects with the China problem, because I could imagine that somewhere in your servers are the emails of Chinese dissidents or Hong Kong protesters or Chinese students living in the United States whose data is being stored in the United States, who the Chinese government wants to keep track of because they may be actually thinking impure thoughts about the Chinese government. So they come to you now and they say, look, the U.S. Supreme Court's made it pretty clear. The U.S. has got reach abroad. Okay? So why wouldn't they use the same principle to come get data on their dissidents out of your servers here in the United States?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that, you know, I think every tech company has really had to think hard about how it would manage. You know, the first thing I would say is I feel like we've got the legal basis under the legislation that was passed last year to resist that under U.S. law because of the nature of the U.S. legal rules in this space, and we definitely would go to court in the United States to contest that. But I think the harder question in some ways is sort of the inevitable one. As all this happens around the world, governments increasingly say, you know what? If you want to provide a service to our citizens, you're going to have to put the data in within our borders. You're going to have to build a data center in, fill in the blank of a country you're concerned
China
about.
China and Russia have already done that, haven't they?
And that's where I think that this is just a fundamental human rights question for our time. And it's, you know, one of the things that really moved us to, frankly, write this book. And, you know, from our perspective, the first question we have to ask is, are we prepared to build a data center in a particular country? And as we described, you know, we have a human rights assessment before we make that decision. The second question that is asked is, even if it seems to make sense to build a data center within a specific country, what kind of data does it make sense to put there? And there are some countries where it might make sense to say, you know, there's some business data that doesn't raise human rights concerns, but like consumer email, you know, those kinds of things, that's a different story. At Microsoft, you know, on those kinds of questions, they ultimately come to me. And there are just days where I just feel like you have to say no. Because if you don't, you are putting people's freedom or even lives at stake. And as we share in the chapter on China, long ago, we were approached and told that if we wanted to provide our consumer email service in China, we would have to move the servers to China. And we said, we get it. That's the law. We're going to shut down our service and we won't offer it to consumers in China. It's one of these amazing topics to me because, at one level, what is the most human aspect of building a business? Once you have a product you're proud of, you want to sell it to anybody who will buy it. I'm like, please buy our book before you leave. That's human nature. But then you realize that there are some people that you should not sell it to. None of you, don't worry. But, you know,
we don't know everybody who's here, yeah.
but for the business that we're in, you have to know when to say no. And then you have this debate, well, if we say no, those people across the street or across the ocean, they'll say yes. How should we think about that? And, you know, in part we say, you know, what we need to do is build a broader understanding. Because at the end of the day, if we protect somebody, but somebody else leads them to, you know, a violation of their rights, you know, the world's not really a better place. So that's, again, part of why we wrote the book, because we want people to think about that. And yet, and there's another thing at the end of the day that I always feel like, I mean, I want our employees to feel that they can come to work and they're not going to confront a day a year from now or three decades from now, when they're having to explain to their friends or their parents or their children or grandchildren why they work for this company, why they work for a company that made these decisions that led to people's lives being impaired this way. And I think our employees would say, I'd rather have a little less profit and feel proud of where I worked. And I just think that's just something that we should all strive for.
So you brought up the question of employees, and it takes me to a question we were all discussing at lunch with you today, which is, how do you define yourself as an American company? And obviously, Microsoft is born in the USA, nurtured on the freedoms of the US, on the tax laws of the US, on the incentives of the U.S. and still try to figure out the degree to which you want to contribute to U.S. offensive capability. And we've seen different companies in the tech industry respond to this in very different ways in recent times. In Google, for just to give the range to everybody, Google employees protested their involvement in something called Project Maven, which was an artificial intelligence program to improve the accuracy of drones, including armed drones. Microsoft is right now bidding, one of the bidders, for the Pentagon Cloud, the JEDI project, which, while is a data storage project, will certainly be helping bolster U.S. defensive capability. I'm not sure you would bid for the same thing in China, right? Amazon is one of your competitors. They have not shown the kind of concern that Google has. Google basically dropped out of Project Maven. I think Amazon's view about providing anything to the U.S. government is they'll do it on Prime and get it there in 2 days. And you sort of fit right in between. So tell us a little bit about how you're thinking about this problem.
I think it has been such an interesting experience for us to have to reason through and learn from. And, you know, we really try to share in a candid way what that process has been like for us and other tech companies. And I think in part it's about what decision to make, and the other part is like, how do you make these decisions? You know, in terms of what decision we made a decision that really had two parts. We said, look, we are an American company. This is a democratic nation. The people decide who they're going to elect, and those people who are elected make the decisions, and we have constitution and protections. There are people every day who risk their lives to defend our nation. We want them to have the best technology we make. We therefore will provide it to them. At the same time, we think there are really important public policy and even ethical and human rights questions that arise around, say, artificial intelligence and what it will mean for weapons. And so we said, you know, we're not going to just go silent on these issues. We're going to engage as a corporate citizen. We'll use our voice. We'll articulate our view. We'll actively engage with policymakers. And we've started to do that around issues like reliability and safety, and most importantly, when are humans in the loop to make decisions about how weapons are used. You know, so that was the conclusion we came to. I think equally interesting, in my experience at least, and what we really tried to bring to life was how to make these decisions. And one of the stories we share is that we came to this view that in some ways leading a company, at least leading a tech company in the year 2019, is in many respects like leading a university. You know, and you know, what do I mean by that? Well, the first thing you think about at universities is you have a lot of people who are not just smart and thoughtful, but they're passionate about what they want their university to do. And you see this, I mean, and, you know, those of us who went to a college, we might have seen it when we were students. You know, we see it in, you know, students today. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we really thought about was universities actually create processes to engage people, you know, to talk about issues, to give people the opportunity to come and share their views. And then they reason through these, and then they make a decision. And when they announce the decision, they not only explain the what, but they explain the why. And we did the same thing with our employees. You know, one of our big points is that, you know, our employees actually expect to have a voice in the decisions we make. It doesn't mean they expect to decide. That's one of the things we found. But they
want the difference between Microsoft and Google. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, one of the things we talked about was you have to decide what you want your culture to be. And we shared in the book that, you know, from our perspective, Google was reacting very quickly to, you know, vocal employees, and we didn't want to have a culture where you just said, oh, well, whoever is the loudest gets to rule, and we'll listen and, you know, then make a decision instantaneously. You know, we wanted to have a process where people are heard, we actually think, and then we make a decision. We just say, hey, everybody, this is what we decided, and you share that within the company, and you share it publicly as well, because when you're a big company, there's hardly a division between internal and external. And what we have found, at least so far for us, is that people feel comfortable with that. They want to work at a place where they're heard. They don't feel they need to be at a place where they alone decide.
Yeah. You have an interesting chapter in the book on a topic I really had not spent a lot of time writing or reporting about. It's about rural broadband, right? And it basically gets to another digital divide, which is that as we get ready to wire up Washington, D.C. and New York and Dallas and all that with 5G, and everybody's sitting here thinking how much faster their cell phones are going to run and whether or not the Chinese are going to end up building the network, you're worried about another thing, which is that it would widen the divide between those people who barely have internet access now, and thus an educational divide and an economic divide. You don't hear this debated all that widely here in Washington about how one gets at this. Is this a corporate problem to solve? Is this a government problem to solve?
It is a national problem to solve. And we are really passionate about this. I am very passionate about this, as you'll probably detect in the next 12 seconds. The first thing we note in this chapter, which is probably one of our favorites, is that broadband has become the electricity of the 21st century. It is so connected to where education is going, healthcare is going, business and job creation is going. You need broadband to just grow and learn and be successful.
Anybody who doubts this, try to take a teen or 20-something to a place that's got no internet connectivity, right?
and one of the things that we do in the book is connect that fact, which we feel strongly about, with the state of not just, you're right, David, economics, but we would also say politics in the United States. Because I think one of the political realities in America today is that many people in rural communities feel that they are being left behind. And as we share, the trip we took to a little town in eastern Washington, in the county that has the highest unemployment rate in the state, usually it's above 16% unemployment, the reason people feel left behind is because they are being left behind. And the lack of confidence that this engenders in their government in Washington, D.C. is just so striking. As we share in the book, we go to the Knotty Pine Diner in downtown Republic, Washington, which is three blocks long. And as we're having a late breakfast with these folks, we talk to them about the fact that the FCC has a national map that says every single person in this county has broadband. And they're telling us around the table that, of course, almost none of them have broadband. And the FCC has been saying forever that they have broadband. And therefore, they don't get any federal funding for that county to try to bring broadband to them. And they just talk about the impact of this on their lives, including a real life or death issue. This is an area that can have massive forest fires in the summer. And the key to fighting these forest fires is actually to know where the fire is and where it's moving, but you can't actually do that if you can't move the data around. And what they have to do to move data around is put it on a thumb drive and put it in a pickup truck and then drive it 45 minutes across the county. And one of the things we do throughout the book is talk about the lessons of history. I think there's a wonderful saying that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And there's an incredible rhyme in our view to what this nation did for electricity. It's a great reminder. It's such a large country. Believe me, when you live in Seattle, you have to get on a long flight to go just about anywhere. And unlike Europe, say in the 1930s, at a time when 90% of rural people in Europe had electricity, only 10% of rural Americans did. And it was Franklin Roosevelt, who said, we are going to make this a national mission to bring electricity to every home, and he created the Rural Electrification Administration. And we went through the Depression, we fought World War II, and when FDR passed away in 1945, 90% of rural America had electricity. And we did the same thing with the landline telephone. And our basic message is, look, if we could do this in the 20th century, we can do it in the 21st century as well. We just have to get ourselves and our minds around this goal, treat it as a social cause, use new technology, unleash the market, and have smarter public policy.
So, Brad, what is it in the political body right now that has made that so difficult? And when you read Robert Caro's LBJ book, I mean, the chapters on him bringing electricity to the Hill Country are fascinating, but it was also a dominating political subject here. This is not.
That's the first problem. You can't solve a problem if you don't understand it, and you can't understand it if you don't talk about it. So that was one of the things that moved us to write that chapter, to try to say, hey, this is something worth talking about. I do worry, in addition, and we describe, you know, some of this to some degree. This is like one of many issues in the book. It's like we've got to find, in our view, some way on these technology issues then to bring people together. And, you know, where we've been stuck in these FCC processes, you know, finally, 2019 actually is a good year. I mean, we made, you know, a passionate cause out of let's get good data. Because how the heck can you bring broadband to people if you don't know who has it and who doesn't? And that has become more of a bipartisan issue on Capitol Hill. You know, Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, he actually has started to really be a champion of this, and it's finally pushing the FCC. You know, we describe going to the FCC. It's another one of the stories we sort of like, because we're at this little, we're at the Knotty Pine Diner, and, you know, these folks say to us, you know, none of us have broadband. Tell that to the FCC. So we did. We went to the FCC. So we described going to FCC Chairman Ajit Pai's office and saying, look, you are not the FCC chairman who created this problem, but please be the FCC chairman to solve it. And, you know, so, you know, slowly but surely. But, you know, as you all know, you know, gridlock is still alive and well in Washington, D.C., and it's part of what we're trying to overcome.
Let's go to some of the questions that have come from the audience here, and here's a very good one. How can technology be used to make elections more reliable, fair, and not subject to foreign interference? I have no idea why someone would be concerned about this, but...
This, too, is you know, this is one of the topics that we really try to take on in the book. And first, I'll just say, we try to share what we're seeing around the world about the problem. And, you know, to be honest, it was not necessarily an easy part to write, because you cannot write about this problem in a direct and candid way unless you're prepared to talk about the role of the Russian government, which we do. You know, and we talk about how we saw, you know, literally 2 days after the Democratic National Convention ended in Philadelphia in 2016, we saw, you know, Russian hacking of additional targets associated with the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign, and how we actually devised a legal strategy which we've been able to deploy to get control and have transferred to us basically the internet domain names that were being used, and therefore, and thereby stop this and then identify who's being hacked. And we followed this around the world, the French presidential election, etc. So we went from the hacking of candidates and really the weaponization of email to disinformation. And we talk about some of the work around the world, the what we've all learned and where we need to go on that. But then we also talk about the problem that we believe should concern us the most, and that is the vulnerability of voting machines. You know, the greatest vulnerability is voting machines that were maybe, you know, purchased between the late 90s and the year 2010. They have old software. You know, we've all read about, you know, the now the well-documented and repeated, I'll just say, probes to go see whether they could be exploited. And not surprisingly, they can. And there's a few points that we also are really passionate about in the book. One is that this could, if not guarded against, be sort of the ultimate disaster for democracy. Imagine it's November, it's a presidential year, one person is elected president by winning three states where the votes are close. We've seen that. Then imagine waking up a week later and finding out that the voting machines in those states have been tampered with, and no one can have confidence that the votes that were counted were actually cast. What would we do? The time to act to protect against this is not after it happens, but before. And so, you know, we've developed technology, we're open sourcing it. It's one of the kinds of steps, many kinds of steps, that we need to take. But the other thing that we just think is so important to remember is, in our view, a really valuable lesson from history. In the first term of the first president, there was the first effort by a foreign government to interfere in American democracy. The French government sent an ambassador, his name was Charles Genet, with the specific instructions to try to sway public opinion to get the fledgling U.S. government to help France in France's war with England. In fact, his instructions authorized him to organize a popular revolt and even overthrow the government if that is what would be required to change the U.S. policy of neutrality that had been articulated by George Washington. And Genet, you know, came ashore, he was going from city to city. There was this unbelievably passionate uprising by people on both sides in some of the major cities. And the interesting thing is, at the time, you know, if you just think about the musical Hamilton, you know, that was an era where, like, politicians literally tried to kill each other in armed duels. Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson were on opposite sides. Jefferson said, you know, let's support France. Hamilton said, no, let's, you know, stay out of this and, you know, be neutral with England. Once Genet got started, Hamilton, Jefferson, and Washington all united. And they all supported the decision that was made to demand that the French recall Genet and get him to stop. And our basic point is, you can't have a democracy unless on issues like this that are fundamental to the protection of democracy, people are able to say, look, we disagree on almost everything, but let's not disagree on this. Let's find a path that gets us to work together to protect our elections.
And how would you assess the U.S. government's effort to learn the lessons from 2016? Yeah, obviously, you're dealing with them all the time, partly because of the open source software you've said. We have a president who's made it clear he doesn't want to be sitting through many meetings on this topic, but you have a FBI, DHS, NSA that say they're working actively on it.
We clearly have not yet done what we need to do. We talk about some of that in the book as well. I mean, you know, let's face it, every time there's a debate that started about, you know, potential hacking of elections from Russia, it quickly devolves into a dispute about the legitimacy of what happened in 2016 rather than a focus on what we need to do to protect ourselves in 2020. So it's been an exercise that has been frustrating. The country's never going to reach a complete agreement about what happened in 2016 and why, but, you know, when do we look forward and just stop arguing about the past? Can we just have like one day and maybe Congress could pass legislation that day and then we could go back to debating things? It is something that we just, you know, we frankly worry about a lot, and we see technology at the heart of it, because this is sort of the tools and weapons analogy. You know, technology is being used as a weapon and could be to tamper with our voting systems. Technology needs to be used as a tool, which we have now worked to create to protect against that.
Which takes us to the next question we have from the audience. Says, knowing the risks and challenges associated with big data and AI, what advice do you have for consumers? So, you know, you can make a good argument that big data and AI are an enormous tool, but we've seen a lot of movies about what kind of weapon they can be.
Frankly, this speaks to another reason we wrote the book. Because we look at the future and we think artificial intelligence is just going to reshape every part of our economy and our society. But if you actually just want to learn about it and how it works, it's not easy. And our industry doesn't make it easy. I mean, we devolve into a lot of jargon. So we actually have three chapters on AI, and part of the first chapter on AI just try to describe, you know, what is this stuff? How does it work? Why is it coming together now? You know, and the different technological advances that are making AI real. You know, so the first thing I would say is when something impacts all our lives, it's helpful to just begin to learn a bit more about it. I do think that one should then really think about where one wants to use it and where not. You know, to some degree, it's already in use all around us. We just don't think about it. There's lots of benefits it creates. Yeah, I happen to be on the board of Netflix. In addition to being at Microsoft, if you use Netflix, you know, you're going to see that the shows that it's showing you reflect an algorithm based on the other shows that you've watched. You know, if you use a music service like Spotify, well, it's going to recommend songs to you. If you have a new car, it may have something that gives you an alert if it picks up a pedestrian, and that's because there's a camera with vision that is based on artificial intelligence. So it is all around us. I think ultimately there are two big questions for all of us. The first is, well, how's it going to change our jobs or our children's jobs? What's it going to mean for me or for them, you know, in terms of their opportunities to be employed, the kinds of skills they're going to need? And so, you know, I think that's something for every family actually to learn about and think about. That's why we devote time to that. And then the second, you know, fundamental question I think that comes to any of us who've ever seen a science fiction movie that involved a computer that decided to stop listening to humans, and there have been many, going back to the movie 2001 in 1968, and, you know, five generations of Terminator movies.
Some of which are pretty good.
Yeah, another one's coming out.
You know, remote work can be
creating a future we can control?
So to make AI work, you need to be able to communicate with the cloud and with anything that is actually producing the artificial intelligence algorithms pretty quickly. So we've got a question here that says, in the race to get 5G to the market, how confident are you that it is safe for people having 5G waves going through the air? How safe is that? And I'd like to add to that, if you're past the health benefit, tell us about the politics of having 5G in foreign and particularly Chinese control if Huawei actually is successful, not here in the United States where it's pretty well barred, but around Europe, Africa, Latin America.
Well, I don't think it's a health hazard. I mean, you know, one thing the FCC does well, I think, is it has a tremendous engineering staff and, you know, a thorough engineering review. I don't think there's, you know, any reason to be more concerned about, you know, 5G waves than, you know, carrying a cell phone today, or for that matter, growing up as I did and having, you know, rapid ears on your television set, knowing that those waves came, or even before that, turning on a radio. It may be different, but, you know, there's a similar kind of review. You know, when it comes to the equipment suppliers, you know, for 5G infrastructure hardware today, one of the interesting things is there's really only four major suppliers in the world. Two are from China, one being Huawei, two are from Europe. So there is no major American supplier. So we will have foreign hardware. I think that there are certainly legitimate questions to ask about different nationalities and what it means, and I think that is an appropriate discussion here and in other places. And as we say in the book, there is a logic for saying that we want that kind of hardware because it will be part of the infrastructure of every part of our country, you know, to perhaps come from NATO allies. But the other point that we make is, there's a lot more to protecting the security of this infrastructure than that. There's a whole lot of other regulatory tools that can and should be used. And we say we have to be really careful. In our view, if you try to, you know, sort of draw a digital iron curtain down the Pacific, we're probably going to hold ourselves back rather than China or anybody else. And we talk about why that is the case in the chapter on China, just given the nature of how software is created.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, and it'll probably have to be our last question because you have a group here of people who are eager to go see some. I hear there's a debate tonight. But let me just pursue that for a moment, because you suggest in the book that trade in software is different than trade in the kind of hardware, and you just mentioned that as well. Tell us what the difference is.
Well, interestingly, first, a lot of the advances in software result from basic research. And it's basic research that happens around the world, most of which is published. That's really the tradition. And so anybody can read it. So, you know, you can stop working with people, but the people you're not working with still get to read about everything you're doing. Mostly you're just stopping yourself from working with and learning from them. Second, one of the interesting things about software, especially over the last 15 years, is the product itself consists of code. I think people sort of know that. Often it's published. It's published as open source code, meaning anybody can see it, they can read it, they can use it and put it in their product. So, you know, it's very different from, you know, what you would think of as especially, you know, classic military, you know, hardware and advanced technology and the like. But the third thing that has just become so striking over the last 10 years is that the software development community is genuinely global in character. You know, developers work together. You know, if you are buying a product from Apple or Microsoft or, you know, any American company, you may know that the hardware is manufactured in China or some other country, but it would be a mistake to think that even aside from that, that it's a product that is just, quote, made in America. It's made in Boston and, you know, in Silicon Valley and Seattle, but also in Bangalore and literally in Beijing and Dublin and London. And all of these different inventions come together. And that's why, you know, when you start to talk about trying to separate the world into, say, one part that has American technology and another part that has Chinese technology, it's actually extraordinarily difficult. That's not the way software tends to work.
One last question for you, Brad. We've got a question here about a Brookings study that indicates that entrepreneurship is declining in the U.S. Our questioner wants to know whether you think that large, almost monopolistic companies are part of the reason for that. Even if you don't believe that to be the case, and I think right now Microsoft is truly the highest capitalized company in the country. So we are interested in whether your answer on that question. How you explain the tech lash that you are seeing now, and which I think I've heard you say President Obama warned you was coming.
Yeah, I mean, just it's a great, you know, thing to maybe conclude on. One of the stories we share is the meeting that took place in the White House in December of 2013 in the wake of the Snowden disclosures. And there was a meeting of, you know, just over a dozen tech leaders, you know, as we describe in the book, names and faces that in many respects you'd all recognize. And, you know, there was a vibrant discussion with most of the tech leaders, really pushing President Obama, Vice President Biden, the White House senior staff, to place more checks and balances on the NSA.
This was right after Snowden, right?
Right after. Snowden's disclosure started in June. This was just 6 months later. And it was a remarkable meeting in many respects. I mean, first, I was just so struck by how much thought President Obama had given to these issues. He had really thought quite deeply about them. And, you know, and he acknowledged this in the conversation as just sort of an incredible conceptual, intellectual puzzle that needed to be addressed. But there was one point as the discussion went around the table where he looked at all the tech leaders and he said, look, I hear you, but I have a suspicion that the guns will turn. You all have more data about the American people than the government does. So you should be thinking about the fact that the demands that you are placing on the government today will someday be placed on you as well. And I actually actually thought he was likely to be right at the time. That's why I wrote it down. Because I always thought that privacy would be, you know, quiet until it wasn't. I long thought that it had similarities to what happened with nuclear power in the United States, you know, because in my view that, you know, we had the nuclear power industry, they were building power plants, but there really wasn't much of a public discussion in the country about the benefits as well as the risks of nuclear power. And hence, when Three Mile Island happened in 1979, no one was really prepared for the backlash against nuclear power. And it literally would take 34 years after Three Mile Island for another nuclear power plant to be built in the United States, very different from most of the world. So fast forward to today and techlash. Look, I think the first reason there is techlash today is because technology is being used as both a tool and a weapon. It's not just the weaponization of, you know, code and cyber weapons. It's the threats to our privacy. It is the impact on the economy, on our jobs, on rural America, on the future of whether we're going to be able to control these increasingly powerful machines. And I think that it's natural that people then ask, what is being done and what are these companies going to do to solve these problems we care about? And so in part, our book is an argument. It's an argument that says that the tech sector needs to wake up, it needs to step up, it needs to assume more responsibility. But we also say government needs to do more. Government's going to need to catch up, it's going to need to move faster, and we're going to have to collaborate together. And you know, I would still say I'm an optimist, a great optimist on what some of these technologies will do. AI should help us cure cancer. It really should. Over the next 10 years, catch up, it's going to need to move faster, and we're going to have to collaborate together. And you know, I would still say I'm an optimist, a great optimist on what some of these technologies will do. AI should help us cure cancer. It really should over the next 10 or 15 years. And that's just a start. But if we don't acknowledge up front the other side of the coin and don't take action to solve these problems, then people are going to become more unhappy and we're going to lose the long-term benefits that we should be pursuing.
Well, Brad, we have not run out of questions, but we have run out of time. Thank you for doing this. Thanks to all of you for coming.